You have once again arrived at your destination. If your destination is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast,
if you live here, you would be home now.
I don't know how you got here if this wasn't your destination. This is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. And again, these are the Rhetorician Files, where I interview rhetoricians. This is back with Dr. Dave Payne. I think this is number 8, our 8th recording. That's like 12 hours of content.
At our length, yeah.
It's amazing.
Well, maybe 4 hours of content, but.
Yeah, well, there's some fluff. You're buying fluff too. Like you're paying for the fluff too. That's the way it goes. So we are, again, on this podcast, playing a little word chess. We're searching for, I don't know, Aristotle Fisher. Would that work?
Aristotle Fisher, sure.
I'm Dr. Dan French, friendly neighborhood rhetorician. The podcast, I interview comedians, I convert conservatives, and I talk to rhetoricians. And that's what we're doing today. Like I said, once again, back with Dr. David Payne. And this is part two of us bloodhounding our way through the world of narratives and
stories. The under thicket of narratives.
Yeah. So I'm going to try to use as many characters and images and stories as I can today. Bloodhounds after the scent of story. That's what we'll start with.
Well, I'll start you off with one little teaser. I mentioned been watching Peaky Blinders a couple times, and that we ran out of those. And so the poor man's version is Boardwalk Empire. So after our session last Monday, jonesing for Peaky Blinders, I watched the first episode of Boardwalk Empire, where Steve Buscemi, one of the first lines out of his mouth is, the first rule of politics is never sacrifice a good story for facts, right?
So. Yeah, there you go. It's almost like these story writers sort of step into rhetorical nests without even knowing it.
No, or maybe some of them know it, yeah.
Maybe. I've been rewatching Game of Thrones in the background while I work, and it's fascinating to me, like, since I've been writing so much on rhetoric and persuasion lately, maybe I'm imprinting it even more strongly than I usually do. But especially going into the last couple of seasons, man, that whole show's about persuasion. Mm. They're constantly like, so Jon Snow arrives in Westeros and has to convince Daenerys that the White Walkers and the Army of the Dead exist, right?
Okay.
And so how do you do that? You know, this fantastical thing, you've got to convince people it's actually real.
What are the available means of persuasion that some sort of nightmarish zombie horde lives above the wall of ice?
Yeah, and they dismiss it with, early on, they dismiss it by calling it Grumpkins and Snarks.
Yeah, see, now in acting school, they would invent these kinds of scenarios, you know. I often thought a lot of the original Star Trek were just these sort of acting school exercise. Pretend that a giant rock creature is, you
know. Yeah.
But in your rhetoric school, you could do this. You're being invaded by zombie hordes from the north.
Well, and it's interesting what he does. You know, again, like they go back and forth and they're trying to do all this persuasion on each other. He finally takes her down into this cave that shows like the first men, and they had etched all these things into the walls. And one of the etchings was the White Walkers. And that convinced her, because it was an authentic symbol coming from a pure world that had no agenda in her world at all.
That's funny.
But that wasn't good enough to convince Cersei. Now they've got to go and convince the evil queen that this exists. And the only way to do that is to go capture one of the White Walkers and bring back empirical evidence. Or one of the dead.
Well, I suppose in one sense of rhetoric, the Game of Thrones is in fact rhetoric. That is, how do you maintain order and or upset it, right? Which is what that's about.
Yeah, and it's, again, like they're all going for the Iron Throne to run 7 basically different kingdoms, and each one has a claim and each one's legitimate versus the story. It's just constantly swirling around there. So I'm going to have to write something about Game of Thrones and persuasion.
Okay. Well,
that's one of those big texts that most everybody has seen.
Maybe you could use that as a way of teasing out your 21 Colosseums that they're in there somewhere.
Yeah. Surely there's there's some.
I gave up. I think I talked to somebody who had read all the books and who said, well, I've been waiting 6 books now for her to do something with those dragons. So I said, well, yeah, I can't wait that long. I gave up.
Yeah. My favorite part of that show, the dialogue of that show is about 60% of the dialogue is just them introducing her. Like Mother of Dragons, Breaker of Chains, The Unburnt. I'm like, yeah, we got all the intro. But those big communal stories like that. So my daughter Quincy is in France and she was talking about all the different interactions she's having with all the different countries because they have, her college has groups where they can all get together. And so she's met Italians and she was talking about the Italians and how they started talking about Breaking Bad. They've all watched American TV and film, and Breaking Bad is universally loved, apparently.
It's a pretty interesting narrative. It really is. I can't recall all the moments I've had with it, thinking about the kind of hero he is, right? But I think it's, what is his motivation? What is Breaking Bad all about? And I think it messes with us quite a lot.
It does. And it's interesting because, you get this tension now very much so in modern drama between the hero and the anti-hero, importing the anti-hero into our major story slot.
Sure.
And that was the slow evolution. Like it took you so long to we got to just softly move him over into the anti-hero. And Quincy was saying, well, but he killed all these people. I'm like, yeah, but he never killed good people. Like the only one good person he ever killed was Mike Armantrout, his nice guy who was a grandpa, even though he was a murderer. But
well, good people do get hurt as a result of their activities. But
yes, but he never pulls the trigger. He kills Nazis. He kills drug dealers. But there's only so much anti-hero that we can handle, I guess.
Well, there's kind of a moral cover. I think Tony Soprano is a really interesting, morally ambiguous hero in that regard, right? I mean, in the case of Tony, he's just trying to live a normal life, but he's his Sisyphean tragedy is his birthright and his culture and being locked inside that criminal, So his problems are unique. I mean, the fact that he's going to a psychiatrist is really fascinating, right? Underground. So I think it really messes with that. He's a tragic hero locked inside of that. And I think Breaking Bad, Walt is another one. Sort of the unraveling of his vocabulary of motives is fascinating. That, okay, he's got cancer. He needs money to protect his family. And notice how keeping the family together is probably the overriding. But by the end of it, his wanting to make the blue meth was a matter of being the best, right? And he was willing to sacrifice all kinds of stuff for that.
Which is also, right within the American ethos, right? That he had been kicked around and failed and abused and not recognized, and he found something he was good at, even if it was criminal, it doesn't matter. In America, you are the best at it, ergo you get to draw real sure. identity from it.
A scientific genius teaching high school, right? Just the recipe for frustration there. And his ex-partner having cashed in on all of the dot-com goodies of whatever. Anyway, it's an interesting set of contrasts.
It is. So, we last time got off into a Trump world, and I don't want to do too much of that, but it is that sense of how much has the American story drifted over into accepting that type of more complicated narrative or more complicated anti.
Well, you could call the Trump story Breaking Good, I guess, if you were. here's this more or less worthless bankrupt guy who never really had any moral guidance at all of a sudden laying claim to this kind of folk heroism, and that the folk maintain, his folk maintain clear to the bitter end, that somehow they see in that sometimes a divinely deceptive and inspired right? The religious take on his moral ambiguity of being, oh, he's like King Cyrus in the Bible, that the Lord used him to do these good things, right?
Right. Well, it is.
So, you know, I mean, it really did call forth a lot of this narrative creativity, I think, to cast him in that role. So, and to believe that somehow he genuinely is trying to do this great thing for America. Although for the life of me, I could never figure out what's that list of great things.
Right.
But that does not dispel in the least the certitude that somehow that's there. So it really is a question of this kind of characterological purity that somehow has managed to be constructed. And I think that is kind of a placeholder in this narrative of redemption and people are looking for. So,
well, and it does really point up the power of story over the power of logic. Like, we keep waiting sure. for evidence. We keep waiting for, you know, to point out what has Trump done to deserve this, like the hypocrisy between his Christianity and the evangelical need to move him up into that evangelical Christian role. And just the power of it, like the drive to make that story real, because they need.
Right. Well, just to note, you said, well, I don't want to go too far, and then we immediately got sucked in. So I think that's part of the power. But
yeah,
but good versus evil has a kind of clarity there that it doesn't anywhere else in the culture.
Well, let's rip it back down out of politics and go into like individual biography. So this morning, I got up and went to the gym, and I was sitting in the steam room, fully clothed, with this other guy, and we started to talk, and he started telling me his life story, which people always do in the steam room for some reason, and sort of within probably 20 minutes,
Nudity, right?
Well, it's at 24 Hour Fitness, everybody has to wear shorts, so it's not complete nudity, but it's
okay,
but. There's this need to share, you know, your biography that people have in these semi-public weird settings like that. And he built a case for what he had done and the choices he had made and where he was going, and all within like 20 minutes. It was just an interesting, you know, view of what story can do so quickly. I never met this guy. I'll never talk to him again, probably. And there you go.
Yeah, I have to say, I think it's fascinating, and I think there was a kind of a cultural turn toward it. It's been ongoing for you know, maybe since the 70s, and what is it, about 1974 when Tom Wolfe coined the phrase the me decade, and now we can no longer even touch what he thought he was talking about in terms of the focus on me. But he was talking, you know, at one moment at least, that essay opens up with Est. And there's a lot of, you know, there was a lot of rhetorical instruction in doing a personal biography there. So I think that was a rhetoric of self, if you will. And there was a lot of, you know, and we attributed at the time, at least, to the kind of the post-collective 60s. What do you do after that? You know, mm-hmm. Jerry Rubin, one of the Chicago Seven guys, winds up going through something like 23 personal self-help languages, right, if you will, on his way to become, I guess, a stock market guy or something. I can't recall exactly what happened to him.
But that's what they said at the end of the movie, that he died.
A lot of refashioning of self, reconciling one's transformations there. So there was a lot of identity work being done. I think that is this, you know, coming up with a coherent narrative that has probability and fidelity and explains one's changes and adaptations is a kind of a burden that we'd been given by modern culture and sociology that, anyway, that's something I've thought a lot about, but the self-help industries were part of that. And, you know, we worked with people in communication that saw personal narrative as this sort of necessary life skill, as well as a special vehicle toward the truth. And of course, I always kind of resisted that as much as I liked personal narrative and autobiography as genres. But, you know, the story is also the best lie.
That's the thing. Like when you're talking about this, I'm saying, yeah, I know it's Austin. So it's in the middle of, you know, pseudo weird. And it's these constant capturings of stories and moving them over to self-help, to some type of psychologically, you know, off some type of psychological offer. But really, you know, in that collision between character, like just pure character in a story, has nothing to do with who you are or your truth or anything like that, versus identity over here, which is supposed to be based in some type of authenticity, I guess, some, you know, biological, you're born this, you know, and you may develop from that or whatever. But I find like character, I see people living characters. I don't really see them having identities. Like I can move them around in the care in the story that they're telling about themselves. Like the guy this morning, he was literally telling me, you know, sort of where he'd lived. And then he broke into his business character, you know, that he had developed this thing and, you know, yada, yada, yada. And I'm like, I just watched you shift to tell me your business story. But it's that sense of character to me, like, and I think it's what you're talking about, that I don't ever see it as truth. I see it as, oh, you've swallowed a certain narrative structure.
Well, the word identity itself contains some of that confusion and conflation, if you will. And identity is by definition how you are known to other people, right? But somehow the self-help age, if you will, or maybe what otherwise it might be called the therapeutic age, gave us the idea that we were given this existential project of finding our true identity, which is an internal thing, right? And then maybe communicating to other people. So you have an identity and you try to then, the rhetorical project is to convince other people that that's really who you are.
Right.
That is a character driven thing, right?
Yeah.
So character and identity in that sense are just two different words for almost the same kind of thing, except character suggests that there's really a kind of a stock group of these. That's why somewhere in the early 80s, I started calling it characterology, that there is a kind of stock set of characters.
Right. That you
end up, and the project of finding my own unique identity, right? Which is quite different from identity politics, would be finding my authentic group identity, I guess, and acting on behalf of it. So, it's an ethical minefield. It really is. I think the thing is to step back and say, what's true about all of these cases? Us looking for the available means of expression / persuasion, because the social problem here is to enact and convince others and to receive the endorsement, right?
Right.
You don't do that, then you're back on self-change again.
Well, and that's when you start looking at the anchor points that allow you to think you've accomplished these things. So like you and I were talking about this, getting to the age where you're primary occupation is gone away as your story vehicle. And now you've got to shift like what, so there's your occupation years and there's a successful life story within those occupation years. And now post-occupation, you've got a new story structure just been dumped on you. What's that look like? And I see this a lot, again, in online dating profiles. The word travel has become like the God word. Like that is
walking on beaches, I guess.
For older people, it's like, oh, I just want to travel. I'm like, oh, okay. When did that get into the story of 60 and above, where that's basically what your life becomes?
Well, I think that's a tempting, nut to crack. Because I think, you know, once again, concurrent with this sort of what you do is who you are, right? That sort of existential mandate that you're defined by your actions. I think once again, once you step out of your career as these sort of definers, and certainly one's, if you talk about personal ads, one's romantic life would undergo a pretty serious categorical overhaul, I should think. I think there's a whole sociological shift that accompanies that. Who are you even talking to? You know, who do you have to be somebody for? So I think I was an engineer. I was, is part of that. I recall sometime, thinking about talking to retired people who would, spent 3 or 4 years, they'd retired even early if they could and spent, some period of time playing golf or whatever, and became so bored that now they're working at Lowe's because they need just some place to go and somebody to be, I guess. Probably not because they needed the money, but
you need a story spine to live, right? So
I think the shriveling there is also of your social groups that for whom, once again, it's back to identity, and identity for oneself, I think, has a limited, that might be a teenage kind of indulgence, but I don't think it does what it needs to do. I guess the psychologist term with the psychosocial dimensions, right? The social activity that reflects back to the self, or the self activity that goes social. But anyway,
what is it supposed to do for you at a certain level when you finally inhabit a certain character, or even if you're thrown into another story and you have to be that character? I've got a friend who went to college with years ago, and he's a morally dubious character, but he's also super financially successful. He may be worth, $50 million at this point with the stuff right. that he does. And all he does is post on Instagram the things that he's bought, his private jet, his third house, his boats, all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, I'm watching you construct a story for everybody, but I know the internal story, some of the internal story behind it. So I can't look at this story as success, but it's clearly that's what he's trying to build. Like, hey, I've got to amplify this character because I've made so many life choices along that story spine. I've really got nothing else.
Well, there's kind of a rhetorical impoverishment there, right? I mean, that these are really, back to the kind of the trope of being able to see the available means of persuasion in any given circumstance there, that one would be in that circumstance rich with all these resources, and that's about the only thing that one can emblematically identify as, create a story out of. And who knows, that might work well enough for their goals. I don't know. I wouldn't want to pass judgment, but.
No, I'm not saying.
You would hope that at least some part of accumulating those resources would be, I now have the leisure time to contemplate more deeply, right?
Right.
And I think that's just it. Once again, there's a kind of the stories of higher transformation in life, there's utter impoverishment. My analysis after many years of research in this very theme, what I consider this very theme, is that basically the most clear-cut story structure for transformation is the adolescent transformation. And our literature and lore are full of movies in the 80s, 90s, especially 2000s, full of adolescent transformations. And I studied those.
So innocence to experience kind of thing?
What's that?
So innocence into experience kind of thing?
That's part of it. That's part of it. Certainly love stories tend to be transformations in that regard. But finding and following, your own drummer, I think the being true to yourself, I wrote the essay about the Dead Poets Society. I think that would be a significant text of that sort. There's tons of other lesser known kinds of, that one has some interesting comic and tragic trajectories in it. But so I think that was kind of the standard thing of becoming one's true self. I think that's part of the psychodrama that's
right.
being played out. But what I started noticing then is that became also the template narratively for midlife transformation. So midlife transformation, at least in terms of these community-based story structures, became by redoing adolescence. Right. Okay. Well, I'm off on a different course here. Right, and once again, there was no master template from the beginning to say one had to do midlife crises. That became a construction, right? when the average lifespan was only 45 years for the male, you didn't have a lot of midlife. And now a midlife crisis can occur even in your early 60s stories and lore and spiritual guidance for higher transformations into later life, simply unavailable as far as I know. I recall sort of noting a few. One of the texts I got interested in that regard was Don Juan DeMarco, Johnny Depp, and Marlon Brando. And Marlon Brando is sort of doing this double identity with the young, somewhat deluded patient, Johnny Depp, who thinks he's Don Juan. Brando is getting ready to retire, and he's looking for his transformation. And sort of gloms on, once again, attaching it to this earlier in life transformation as a vehicle. So at any rate, to me, the bottom line of all of that is just that all of those stories sell transformation.
Is it the experience of transformation? I see, again, I really should just do a profile of the online dating world, just not for its... There's a bunch of humor in it for sure, but there's all sorts of these themes, especially again for older people that are still dating, of transformation. Like you see accomplishment rhetoric. Like one of the things I do is when I for some reason I got into a hobby of when women post pictures of themselves at Machu Picchu.
Okay, sure.
On top of the mountain. They're all over the place. I bet you one in every 20, 25 online profiles. Machu Picchu. Has a picture, you know, of them, and they're all in the exact same spot with the ruins behind them that they've overcome the mountain. And like, they show this as part of the way that they're attracting people.
Adventure, travel, health, right? There's some of us who can't really contemplate getting to the top of Machu Picchu, right?
But it has the spirituality of a pure culture behind it and all this stuff. And I see this accomplishment and mysticism and trying to get outside of the Western culture and American stories and co-op.
So you've identified a trope, right? That is a visual embedded trope in that rhetoric of. I don't know that one wants to in those venues market transfer. You know, I think people are looking for transformation because I think that's the way.
I think what they're trying to do is love is sold
as a transformative.
Trying to find validation from an audience that recognizes their transformation or others who are interested in pursuing transformations. They also do Kilimanjaro. They do, you know, there's a lot of that kind of stuff of big accomplishment on a huge vista, you know, that will give it enough gravitas, enough trajectory to feel like they've actually transformed. Whereas, have they transformed?
The question of whether there any actual transformation takes place is another question altogether. The question is, you know, how are we shopping for it, and how do we symbolize it, right? How do you sell it? And so, I would think, in some part, you know. I am accomplished. I am financially independent. So that I think stability would be a big character rhetoric, if you will. But that's marketing oneself as a potential transformer, right?
Transformers. That's what it all is. It all goes back to that's the major American trope. That's why they made 42 shitty movies about robots that. Can become something that's not a robot.
Well, it's kind of, you know, there is this sort of Cinderella version of romance where we know people look for true love, but then it often involves a change of economic status. The rich people are typically without soul, without meaning. And they want to glom onto the lower class people who are living this more rich, meaningful life. So they're looking for spiritual transformation or renewal in that regard. But, you know, the poor girl is always winds up being more interested in the deep inner, right, spirit of the rich guy, because that's also transformative. So everything from Pretty Woman to Working Girl, I mean, it's over and over and over and over.
Right. Well, and you see it too with, so one of the big villains that emerges from divorces these days is the narcissist. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure how the narcissist leapt out of the psychology world and over into pop culture so much, but it is the diagnosis that people have for those that they've gone through bad relationships with. And narcissist is just the flip side characterologically of believing in oneself, no matter what, right? So you get this anti-villain where the narcissist believes too far, goes all the way over here, but the hero is believing oneself against all odds, no matter what anybody says, you know, you stay authentic. But it's the same character, it's just gone in a different extreme.
Yeah, that's interesting. I suspect it's probably not a very accurate use of the term narcissist, which, and that's probably unfortunate, since I think we are dealing with real clinical conditions of narcissism in many cases, where somebody must, you know, be the hero or the villain of every story. It's all about them. I can see why that would be an accusation to hurl toward.
Yeah, it's a super spouse. Character slot.
Part of the rupture, part of the process of individuating from the relationship is, I'm interested in my own stuff, right? Yeah, what happens to me is now the single most issue. I'm no longer doing stuff to make you feel better about yourself. So I can see why, in the polarization process of divorce, that would be the thing to suspect of one's partner or ex-partner.
I think it's fun. Like, comedy goes in again and harvests from this stuff in such a different way. The other day I wrote a tweet that was me and you, but mostly me. And I'm like, yeah, I can see that. That's the true Valentine's Day cards, right? A whole line of, yeah. But it is this sense where people are, I think, especially when you get older, your stories dissolve. Like, my kids just moved out and I've been a parent since I was 40 or so. And so the last 21 years, I've been an active parent with two kids around, driving my kid to high school, having that moral base and all that kind of stuff. Now they're gone and they're both seem to be fairly independent. Like, they're not probably not coming back, at least anytime soon, that where I have to take care of them. And so I'm like, wow, that story just ended.
And sort of leaves the life hollowed out, I suspect, right? Because that has been your, that's what I always tell people that are having children, is that, well, you no longer have to worry about what to do with your time or your money for the next 25 years, right?
Yeah. Oh, it's all encompassing for sure.
But after that, you do have to sort of figure that out.
When I did a seminar once for a friend of mine who was teaching a course at his church for empty nest couples, older couples that had their kids had just gone off to college or were gone, and just the psychological storm that hits when that happens, because suddenly there is no place to offload your issues to, you know, to just sort of work together, you know, in kind of a just drudgery, let's get through this kind of way. Now you've got to actually deal with each other. And it was really interesting talking to these people. It was probably, I don't know, 10 or 12 couples, and just gathering some of their life stories and just watching the communication voids, just kind of staring at each other. Like, I don't want to talk about your stuff. And I don't want to talk about your stuff. What do we got?
There was an article on this very thing this week I looked at I think, and I hate to quote statistics that I can't remember very well, but I think the claim was that divorce is spiking amongst the younger boomer gang that are entering retirement, because they no longer have the family to tie them down. Right, and keep them from addressing these issues in their relationship, as well as they have the money that they can afford. You know, they don't have the economic confinement to stay together. And if you take away money and kids, you've got two of the primary reasons for marriage. knocked out from under you, right?
Well, you're starting to see, I think, one of the interesting things about technology and the way it impacts human structures, like online dating is a new social technology. Like you can access people in ways that you could never have done before. I've been divorced for almost 15 years, or more than 15 years now. And I've met hundreds of people for coffees and things like that over the years that I would never have talked to in any other format. And so you're, in one way, you know, we're going back to story, the idea that we've always had this primary story in America where you meet somebody that's roughly what you want and you get married because nothing else that's probably as good as you're going to get. It's not like you've got consumption relationship structures out there where you can just move through them as a lifestyle. And there are a lot of people that will put on their dating profiles that they don't want serial daters, you know, because it is that people are starting to use that stuff to be, it's not even for sex all the time. It's just consumption of relationships, but it's a viable story now.
Well, and kind of once again, endless renewal, I think, if for some of them, right. There's always something better waiting.
Or endless depression. They also get very cynical about this is awful. It's just always bad. And so they opt out of this.
Serial depression or disappointment.
So all these story slots, these narrative grooves that are offered to people in our culture, they are, I think, evolving some with technology and such.
Well, certainly there's a commodity dimension to the rhetoric of self that one would have to, that would put a new demand on that you need to come up with. I forget what was racing through my head was at least one romantic comedy where the guy's being advised to pretend that his wife has died, that this is the most marketable story.
I think it was a Seinfeld. It was a Seinfeld episode.
Could be. But I think that somehow this is the kind of sympathies that one will encounter there. Anyway.
Well, make it like, let's keep it again in personal biography. So you're talking about maybe moving or at least exploring other areas of the country. You've been a professor for 30, 40 years. You lived that life. You were a parent. You're a husband. What's the dominant narrative going to be now? Like travel?
Well, it would be nice if narratives made your decisions for you. And I suppose they could.
Yeah, if you choose one, right? So I'm going to be a wanderer.
I suppose they could. And I sort of pay attention to them in that way. Oh, so-and-so is moving closer to their grandchildren or, the reasons why people are doing the things they're doing. Unfortunately, I think being a critic immunizes me a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. It's hard to sell yourself.
A little bit from. So I guess I'm a believer in to charge ahead and then make the story up afterward. But
well, you probably, one of the things about being a rhetorician is you can't wholeheartedly throw yourself into anything. Because you know it's a construction. You're like, this is a myth. This is also a mythology. I can't really, rely on it.
Right. I've had some aha moments about this that probably are relevant, but I also don't market my psyche that much to go into it, but. I don't know that recognizing these are good stories or accumulating things as good stories. Although I think that is an activity in the things that people do, is it makes a good story. And so the vacations they take, the experience, there are experienced collectors out there.
Right.
And somehow that probably does seep into their personal ad profile as experienced collectors. So, I'm sure I've said that before. Well, let's do this because it'll make a better story later.
Well, I think part of that, finding the value, everybody has to find some kind of value, I think, in things as, again, a therapeutic, especially a retrospective therapeutic. And I hear this one a lot, and I've pointed this out to people. We're like, well, I learned, there's no wasted time because I learned something. I'm like, so that's the big value, is that you learned a lesson that you probably could have learned by reading a comic book, if it was the right comic book.
Well, that's one of the big consolations for it, right? For loss, sure. Right?
Yeah, it's one of those therapeutic nuggets.
There's even a Latin formula for it. I won't recall it, but that through the suffering, there is learning. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So lessons this collecting of life lessons becomes the telos.
And there's a religious background to that too. Every religion is that Marcel Eliade. There's no world religion that doesn't specify the normality of suffering. It all begins with suffering as the given, right? And through that, right, some greater spiritual reward or transformation is made available to you if you know how. So I think that kind of interpretive work is pretty well wired. But I guess the time that I can think of that is the need to go on some kind of adventure. Why not? Right. So something that. You know, gives up the safe and the secure and the homebound and engages in some kind of adventure. Just is to me the more appealing, I guess. And I think once again, once you start negotiating with and how much trouble it is, and how much does it cost? We'll take the cruise. We'll take the cruise to Cancun instead, right?
Well, I've made this point to people many times. People will be like, "Oh, you know, I love nature." I'm like, "No, you don't. You love curated nature. We've already gone in there and killed everything that wants to kill you. You know, you're not experiencing nature. You're experiencing this groomed version, theme park version of nature that human beings have created."
Sure. Well, I love to camp and always thought I would want to do that. But now at this age, the ghost, man, the tent, building the fire, sleeping on the ground. And I guess that's why most people buy a, you know, $100,000 RV and go park right next door to somebody else's $100,000 RV, right? So,
yeah. So when I look at this stuff as, again, as a rhetorical tool, story in the 21 Colosseums world is here's how you use story if you want to try to move people towards something, versus watching how people use story in so many ways in our culture. Again, like you said, for therapeutic value or for adding meaning or for avoiding the listlessness that you get if you don't have meaning. You know, this kind of dystopian versus utopian life where you watch people, if they've been suffered enough, knocked down enough, they have to reach up to some kind of story structure to keep going. And I think that's why the lessons of, at least I learned, I survived, I'm a survivor, I got past that. You know, all those become very valuable to people as life equipment, you know, and I see like with maybe that's part of the, I don't want to get back into Trump again, but maybe that's part of his offer is that for people who are being knocked down culturally back into back, you know, the regressive America that doesn't want to move into the future, he's offering therapy for that.
Well, but yeah, you know, but I tend to err on the side of, once again, kind of the Eric Hoffer true believer diagnosis that this is stagnation in their personal lives. This is a disappointed narrative of where they might want to be, and so they're not getting more, they're not making more money, they're not having more fun, they're not whatever it is that in this culture signifies success. And for many of them, I mean, it's not just personal, but it's also in the environments they're in, that those are stagnated, decaying environments. And that's a very real thing in these industrial parts throughout the Northeast. And you know, small towns have it. You know, they're emptying out. The children are moving to the cities. So, I mean, those people have to be coming from somewhere. Mm-hmm. There is stagnation, and not just stagnation, but also decay. In the environment and their place in it. There's no power there. So, and no improvement. So I definitely, you know, but the Hoffer language rings to me that here's the opportunity to participate in some soul stirring, spectacular undertaking. And that's why he wants to call it the greatest American movement. That phrase has been coined with other nationalities.
Right.
So it is a collective enterprise of individuals, and that is an opportunity to re-narrate your outcome, right? So if you're midlife and the last good story you have to tell was the high school football game or stuff you did in the Army or, you know, whatever it happens to be, there is that nagging desire to.
Well, it does. It needs, I mean, stories need that type of, heft and aura. You need to tell the great story. Living a mediocre story. There's this, again, being married to a psychotherapist at some point. There were all these things that would float to me, these little fragment lessons from psychotherapy. And one was, it was kind of antidote to megalomania, like even low levels of megalomania, that America tells everybody they need to be special and they need to live a big life. And that there's a therapeutic value in just saying it's okay to live a small life. It's okay to not constantly accomplish. You're not failing. You're just living. And watching
footnote here, that is the line in the opening of The Big Chill, the sort of mid-80s, where did our lives go, right? Existential angst from the aging boomers there from the 60s. And that's what the preacher says. What happened to, you know, wasn't there a day when he's giving the eulogy for Alex who killed himself, when the rewards of being a good man weren't enough?
Right. Yeah.
Where did hope go? Right. So, the breakdown of the redeemables of the good, modest, yeoman-like life where you go to work and you pay your bills and love your family somehow ceased to be characterologically enough.
Well, that's not the American story anymore. It's not a small life story. It's a big life story. There was some kind of transition at some point where it went from, like you're talking about, the sort of yeoman, I can take care of my family, move them along a little bit, and be a hard worker and be a good person, into I need a big life in order to be American and to feel like I've succeeded in this story.
Right. Well, that's certainly part of it, and I think and a huge part of it. But I also think about, you know, who bought into that preacher's living the good life was enough. You know, the Christian what we would hope to idealize as that. But if you look at the tragic story there being, I mean, this is the rhetoric of the fall. It's not just personal gain, but also dramatic loss here. They're afraid they're going to end this. That is the revivalist technique. What would happen if you died tonight? Oh, where, you know, I'm not on the right side of the ledger here, right? So I think there are those tragic dystopian narratives out there too, right?
But when you look at the sense of failure in story versus the sense of success in story. Like, I see this a lot. I see people struggling with this. Again, looking at my kids, my son is already successful business-wise. He trained himself to do video editing and special effects, and that matches up very well with the industry that he's in right now. He's 18, and he's always had more success than I had until I was probably in my 30s. And I watch him as a trajectory and him trying to figure out all the other things that go along with that. Like, he's not going to college. So that's not he's not going to have that success narrative, that educational narrative that I just held on to education like it was driftwood to take me out of Kentucky. I just stayed on it until it floated me far enough away. So when you look at success and failure within
It was a way out of your class, but it was also his way out of the class, right? That's not his situation.
Yeah, he was already out of the class. Like, I mean, yeah, like he, yeah. Hey, you're starting a third of the way down the track, buddy.
My dad's a PhD and a success. Yeah, sure. And living in a nice house. So yeah.
Yeah, and so when
to escape Louisville.
Right.
He needed to find himself in Austin, which is a whole different game board. Anyway.
Yeah. So he started out, he was born on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles.
There you go.
I'm like, I was born in some, I can't even remember but when I go back and so I do a lot of biography work, a lot of reputation work for people in business.
Sure.
And if you let that expand into its full narrative, logical character structures, you're going to blow your head apart because there's so much life in every single person. And you're like, how do I get some kind of orb around this to where I know what to harvest? And it goes back to, like, when I start to build Rhetoric Warriors and try to make it a brand, you have to write, you know, a bio for yourself, some type of promotionable bio. And so I moved my original bio back. I was born in Louisville. my father was actually born on tobacco farm in Western Kentucky. Like my grandfather was the first person in the entire lineage to move off of tobacco farms. So I'm like, I'm going to go back and rescue that as my starting point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Somewhere I have a huge diagram of all these, what I would call points of transformation, and origins is certainly one of them, right? Endings is another. The history of one's group, the future of one's group, these are kind of major coordinates of what we would call identity. If you're going to go storying it, absolutely.
Yeah, so if I want to add success into my story, I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to go all the way back to tobacco farms, and I'm one generation off tobacco farms. I'm doing fine, you know?
Right. What I think we do is that we have the flexibility to plot both continuities. So there is a continuous story of ascent from the tobacco farm to the son, the video editor, that is all part of you and your narrative. And I guess that's the other thing we do in later in life as we start living vicariously through our children in their arcs. But and then there's also the story of disruptions, and those two things have to reconcile themselves. So we can, it isn't two different bags, failure and success. These are part of the same interwoven fabric, that success comes very often in stories from failures, right?
Well, it's a stronger story if you've experienced failure and overcome that. So it gives you a second story as opposed
to that. Well, as the novelist Tom Robbins says, success eliminates just as many options as failure. If you succeeded too early, you couldn't have had this great success, right?
Yeah.
I was getting written recently by a business professor who was working with these CEO narratives, like, you know, Lee Iacocca's book. Apparently there's this whole genre of them. He was musing and asking me, because of my work, why would somebody come out and write a book about when they're considered a failure in their CEO position? So I've recently made all of these arguments that, you know, there are just so many moves you can make on failure. One of them is this higher success, right? And come to find out, Lee Iacocca's second book is, after he's already been deemed a failure from the first sort of heroic rise to godhood, we're not dealing with that, because we're dealing only with these success trajectories. At any rate, most of these success trajectories are woven from these earlier failures, which really weren't failures. They were, as you pointed out, learning experiences. Anyway.
Well, they're temporary failures.
If he succeeded in any one of those things, might not have turned into the thing that he did. So,
yeah, it's... I think the continuity is a really useful idea in there. The idea that, yeah, you got failure points along the continuity line, but they're always followed at some level by a success point. Even if you have to move down to moral success, if you can't have financial sure. success, jump over to moral success to counterbalance the failure somewhere else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, spiritual goods, that's when the failure is undeniable. You compensate as long as possible with material success, but if that ends, then it's a spiritual, yeah. And that's ultimately where we all wind up, right? So.
Well, yeah, unless you're the existentialist. Like I keep looking at, I wrote a thing this week of existentialist versions of children's books. It's on my Facebook if anybody wants to go check it out, but it's essentially like Why the Wild Things Are, you know, the giving up tree.
I like it.
So it's this sense of, you know, there's always hope. There's hope, there's hope, there's hope. It's like you were talking about in The Big Chill. That I used to play that opening speech a lot when I taught public speaking. So it's burned into my brain. Well, somebody will say a word that's close to it, and that guy will just pop back up, and I'll just start redoing. I'll start monologuing the speech. But he does, like, where did Alex's hope go?
Right.
You know, and it's that sense of constantly balancing this successes and failures, and where am I supposed to get to where I can go? Yes, I succeeded. Now I can retire and just bask in that success.
Well, I guess that's the other narratological imperative, perhaps. Are you ever supposed to arrive? And it seems to me that my existential insight is that these are all passages, right? It's always changing. You can't really do anything about that because the biological imperative is there. So how do you then work on that with story and transformation?
It seems like a more moral offer to give people, like, hey, these are story structures and you can really draw satisfaction and meaning from them. They're still arbitrary structures, but that's okay, versus what I see a lot in the full-on psych community of, you need to find an authentic feeling of success and identity. And I'm like, that seems like an awfully high bar to give people. And you can just see they want it so badly to get into that authenticity feeling.
Oh yeah. 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 No, everybody's looking to grab something, you know, the number of successful people, for instance, over the years that come back to school to get a PhD, and they come in with, well, I want to study international business, and they wind up getting into jazz because that's really what they always love.
Right.
They're trying to seize on some sort of personally meaningful, you know, so that we overdo the success thing. I forget the name of the book, but some years ago, there was a guy who was doing a lot of CEO consulting and using poetry and Zen stories. I mean, when you say there are stories that do, yeah, what's the set of Zen cones except that kind of little nuggets of meaning that reflect back that, right, it's not about achievement, it's about the journey or something like that. But anyway, he was using all this kind of stuff to go in and charge executives lots of money for the retreat, which takes them away, you know, into a world of meaning and narrative and symbolic enrichment, as opposed to how to win friends and get better at what you're doing. And I think that would sell very well among the successful, right?
Yeah.
Or if you look at the original stuff with Est in any detail, these tended to be successful people. They weren't looking at recipes for success. They were looking to moralize the changes they went through to become successful. Is, I guess, one possible way of looking at it.
It's kind of fascinating. Est became Landmark out in LA, and there's still a lot of Landmark people. I find, in fact, I bet if you looked at a lot of the Trump MAGA world, there's a significant number of them that are Landmark people.
Hmm.
And it's it's like the Tony Robbins thing where they go and they rescue enough psych talk or even rhetoric talk or a lot of communication stuff, and they'll bring enough of it back that it makes sense. It's got some viability to it because somebody else wrote it that has an actual academic mind about it. And they'll rescue enough and then jam it into people's minds through some type of group psychology. But I see so many people still holding on to that structure, and they'll, every once in a while, I'll be talking to them about something from rhetoric or communication theory, and they'll be like, that sounds just like Est or just like Landmark. And I'm like, that's because Landmark stole it from real academics, you know, turned it into a mind product that they can transfer.
Or there was pop psychology, which fueled all of the above, basically, I think. And once again, pop existentialism, that whole sense of you're delivered here. And I do think it, you know, my Marxist leaning past whatever, that this only occurs when there's a certain amount of leisure income and time, right, for people to worry about what their story is.
Sure.
And I think it also bespeaks a kind of a media age that, and a rhetorical technology about talking to yourself. This old study of oral cultures, you know, they say, well, tell me about yourself. And the guy would, from a purely oral culture would say, well, ask my friends. I don't know. The question made no sense. I don't make talk about myself.
Right.
How would I know? But now, from the time you learn to fill out your first CV and job ad and application, and, you know, there's such a demand for what I'm calling this rhetoric of self. How do you story who you are? I think, once again, I think that that's been a factor for the last 50 years or so as part of our age, part of a characterological, sociological phenomenon. So anyway, so personal bio, personal story, I think is a huge, huge department. I know whether it's a coliseum or not, but it's
Well, it's definitely in the story coliseum, probably in the psyche coliseum.
Well, and too. I think other stories have to give you that equipment for living, to coin a phrase. I do think that that's part of what our success literature, part of what our CEO narratives, part of what our mass movements, political movements, they must give you the equipment for restoring your life, with a kind of a pun on restoring. I do think that's, if you look at simply, you know, something like feminism, completely uncynically at the equipment, you know, and the consciousness raising experiences of how do you retell what happened to you and how you became and how do you talk about the changes that you're making? That becomes very, you know, dramatically rhetorical technologies for self-change, right? There is a vital part of that as well.
When I watch, again, I've tried to watch my kids and the way they access story, and we watch a ton of stuff together. It's one of the ways that I've socialized, especially with my daughter, that when she was here after the pandemic hit and she came back here for a year while she was a junior in the communication/rhetoric program at UNT, North Texas, I was talking to her about this stuff and we'd watch something together and I would do a little bit of, you know, rhetoric with her just because it was fun. She had a little bit of the terminology and some interest in it, but like we would watch, do you watch Chef's Table?
I think I've seen it.
Beautiful little documentaries. They also have one called,
I was just saying PBS version or something. Anyway, I think I know what you're talking about.
It's on Netflix and it's got higher budgets and
Anthony Bourdain did some of them, I think, narrated some of them. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. And they're doing real, documentary. So the film quality, everything is just gorgeous. And every once in a while they'll hit the right theme on a story about, there was a guy from the Amazon. He was a Brazilian punk, had a tough life and then became a chef. And basically the story is always the same, that they go back into a natural setting from whence their families and communities came and they rescue the cuisine and they turn it into a Michelin star restaurant.
Right.
And this guy did a thing where he went and caught this fish from, you know, right from the Amazon. And it was this prehistoric fish that they could barely scale because the thing was so armored and it took him forever and he's sweating and everything else. And he finally gets it done and serves it. And everybody's like, yeah, it's good. But it's the sense of having that kind of past to go back into that's so story thick and so story rich and authentic.
Or I was raised by Amazon. This kind of food, and now I run that place in New York City that serves this kind of food, and it's amazing.
Yeah, but I've literally gone back and found the authentic elements of the story and brought them here in an authentic way so that you can now access it. And people you can just see it. They're just going in and just, they're eating story.
Well, there is some of that it's no longer just the visual. They used to say, you know, you eat with your eyes, but now you got to have the story too. I call at least one of those, but I think a couple where they would also interview very accomplished chefs that at one time would have the 3-star Michelin restaurant, but now they live in their own private villa and do nothing but cook on open flames and stuff like this, right?
They rescue the old techniques. So they would, you know, they did a lot of the pit cooking where, you know, cover it in banana leaves and
they must kill their own game. You know, there's all kinds of advanced trips out there, right?
And so how do you get that in America? Where are our, you know, sort of rich pockets of history? And I think in some ways, like with the Civil War, Confederate monuments and all that, that was part of what they're trying to get at, right? Is that we have no history, no real authentic rich grown from the earth history in America, and now we're getting rid of the stuff we've got.
The food author Jim Harrison, who also wrote the story on which Legends of the Fall was made, but he's got a couple of books that are really that kind of reclaiming in the chefy mode. But
yeah, and food's one of the places where they definitely do that. And I watched, you know, the Kentucky Derby was this past weekend, and same thing. I'm like, this is this is Old South plantation culture that you guys have sanitized to the point where you can show it on TV and make it like everybody can dress like that and drink the mint juleps. And I'm like, you've just dropped the elements, the ugly elements out of that. So everybody can access that story again. They can wear the costume.
I will tell you the story only because it has local and relevance, and it goes over a number of things that we've talked about, because it's my confession in that whole register, because I'm kind of a foodie. Last time we were in Austin, I had seen on the food channel, Best Thing I Ever Ate, which are these narratives about the food I ate from these famous chefs, right? That's what it all is. And one of them was this new restaurant in Austin. And so we went there, and sitting next to this crowded tables, right? This little tiny table. And so I ordered the brisket taco, street taco, whatever it is.
Was it barley swine?
I can't remember, but they'd been on TV that this was the best. Eric Sanchez said, this is the best thing I ever ate. And the girl next to me, young woman at the next to me, says, it will change your life. and so that's been a real callback around our house, because, and it was okay, but I regularly make street tacos out of authentic materials that are every bit as good, if not better. And I don't pay, you know, $36 for three bites. So we were just joking the other day as I was eating my street tacos that it'll change your life. But it has that that narratological portent in it, right? As well as seeking experience collecting. And I think food is a big vehicle for that in terms of.
Well, I think you've just nailed your future. Like, you come to Austin, open a food truck called It Will Change Your Life.
There you go. There you go. Seems like a lot to claim. A lot to claim.
Hey, overclaim is not a problem in America.
Well, that's right. And it doesn't have to have much durability, right? That form of that street taco. And that's what I guess stuck in both of our funny bones about this is, what was your life before? But this is going to change your life. Really?
Sometimes it doesn't take much.
What are the other main taproots of this thing you call a life that anyway?
When I think about that seeking of change, that's what everybody is seeking. Something's powerful.
Our new experience, our exotic experience, sure.
But it's got to be powerful enough to cut through, you know, maybe 50 years of life, or the dystopian experience of consumption, the plastic, you know, experience of consumption culture. It's got a lot of work to do to actually get some type of powerful effect on people these days. And that's why I see all these middle-aged white people here in Austin, especially, and it was in LA too. They're all wanting to take ayahuasca and all these psychotropic Amazon drugs and South American drugs, because they want something that's just strong enough to cut through it.
I think that's right. We're talking about stories of self and self-change. I think it's an old book, but it's Walker Percy's Lost in the Cosmos, the Last Self-Help Book, is an absolute riot. And he's all about this. Boredom and stagnation, period. Once again, in a world where we have all of these fast paced, we're literally immersed in these narratives of transformation that take place in the confines of 2 hours. And we just feed that, stoke that constantly. You know, the identification with that, and you look at your life, but the line that always stuck me from Walker Percy's book, he says, under the same conditions that a human gets bored, a dog will simply fall asleep.
Yeah. I remember that too. That's a strong one.
That's, to me, is kind of a basis for comparison here. that you're awake wanting something stimulating to do, and the dog simply falls asleep.
So. Yeah. It's interesting, again, within story, when something pierces the kind of malaise. Well, that's a Walker Percy word, malaise. I think he had that in the movie Goer a lot. But I remember when Fleabag, we talked about Fleabag a little bit. Did you ever watch Fleabag?
I watched some of it. It didn't catch with me. Okay. But
Well, it's different for everybody. But Fleabag is one of those ones that caught for a lot of people. And it did for me, because the humor, the same way early South Park did, it went right for the jugular. like the opening joke in Fleabag, you know, is a very long extended anal joke. And it is right there. Like that's the first joke. And you're like, wow. And it just,
you're the connoisseur, right?
You know, it just cuts through all the veneer. Everything else goes right through.
Perfect opening tracking shot. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So it has some story power to me. Like usually you don't see that stuff. You see that stuff a lot in stand-up because stand-ups are always having to one-up themselves and everybody else to try to get, you know, some type of power into their monologue. So they go for things like that a lot, but you don't see it that much in mainstream narrative.
Plus getting a good thematic thing going. I mean, that's high art in stand-up world, right? That you can call back to a number of times.
Yeah, and there are guys that are super artists at it. Doug Stanhope is a guy that sort of was one of the inheritors of Bill Hicks. Doesn't have quite the mental level on the abstract level as Hicks, but he's really smart and can really artfully write around very deviant topics. And when you watch people do that well, you're like, oh, okay, so the art is strong enough to even talk about these incredibly incendiary topics. But they're so artful in it that you can't catch them in some type of moral, you know, flaw. So it's kind of fun to watch.
There's a genre of personal bio. Is the stand-up comic routine is very often, right, reviewing the events of your life and a humorous register, right? May take license, but especially the number of female comics that's what the routine is.
I don't know if you've watched this lately, this trend where Netflix started doing a lot of this with this woman, Hannah Gadsby, where they called it stand-up, but it was essentially personal confession or, you know, that sort of more traditional, what you would get in theater, you know, one person show kind of stuff of here's the intimate
Oprah, yeah.
Revelation of the horrible
professional genres out there. Sure.
Yeah. And I'm like, get that out of my stand-up. I don't need the real here. Like I'm paying for the real to be treated in a certain way so that I can enjoy it.
Right. I do think that's right. That when you interrupt that with these moments of complete gravity is kind of off-putting, but
yeah.
You want it to blur and whir and go someplace else.
So it's interesting. The
but that itself could be a therapeutic stance toward, you know, the events of the past, which you know could easily be tragic.
Well, and a lot of people loved it. I had lots of people that I would meet and they'd be talking about it, like, have you seen this? And I'm like, yeah, I saw it. I hated it. You know, I'm like, if I want drama, if I want tragedy, I will go access it. I know where to access it. Keep it out of my comedy. You know, you're just trespassing at this point into my story structures.
Boy, you know, I guess I've theorized, speculated, whatever, that in a number of different ways that we Americans don't have much tolerance for tragedy, period. When we get it in our dramas, it's pretty heavily laminated. There'll be this serious moment and then immediately flash to some lighthearted. That's when that, you know, you get the 60s song or something, that interlude. And in terms of the narrative structures, even something dramatically profound and potentially tragic loss is immediately repaired or held in suspension by some sort of comic structure. I think I called it at one time tragic containment. Really don't want to let it out of the can. And so I think you would look long and hard for any real serious tragic content in our literature and media these days. That isn't to say it isn't there, but it's heavily contained.
It's not. That is not what America is selling as a story structure, for sure. Even going back to Game of Thrones, everybody hated the last season. They hated the finale because one of the main good characters, the heroine of the whole thing, turned evil. And I watched a guy talk years ago, Victor something. He had made the movie Ruby in Paradise and Yuli's Gold. And he was talking about the first two films he had made as a regional filmmaker down in Florida. He had starred Ed Harris in one and wrote the story. And at the end, the hero makes the wrong choice and turns evil. And he's like, people hated that movie in ways I can't even describe to you. Like, that is the ultimate anti-American story, is where you can't watch a good person go bad. Now you can take the other way, but we just can't take that type of of story structure.
Yeah. You know, an interesting kind of meta parody on the movies is in the 90s, right? Robert Altman's The Player, where one of the kind of almost a gag running through it is this guy trying to sell a script that ends tragically. And when they finally make the movie, we see at the very end that Bruce Willis breaks in and steals Julia Roberts from the gas chamber, right? Because we simply will not tolerate.
Yeah. Well, I read the Where the Red Fern Grows to my kids when they were little. I changed the ending.
Sure.
I did not want to deal with my five-year-old son, you know, and his emotions about those two dogs dying. So they left him with, instead of them dying, he left them with a friend of his in the mountains, and they moved to the city.
Yeah, well, what if, you know, Bambi, which is, right, Bambi's mom getting killed in the middle of the story is just about the most traumatic. what if the forest fire would have burned down all the animals? I mean,
well, maybe that's why, like with the Trump thing, it took so long for people to take it seriously that this could actually be an emergence of fascism. I mean, it's still trying to pull out the election.
It ain't over, yeah.
Like, people just don't believe it. They're like, that could never happen in America because we've told this one story to ourselves so long and so strongly that it just doesn't even seem possible to imagine it.
Well, you know, and then there needs to be, you know, a psychology course or curriculum designed to, you know, on the rationalization that the election was stolen. This is not just factual, back to our theme, this is not just factual error. This is not just belief. This is, right, I got on board of this narrative and was so utterly convinced in its redemptive qualities. There's only one explanation. Right. So that, you know, the news this week that the Arizonans are pouring over the ballots to look for bamboo fibers as evidence that 40,000 ballots came from China, or watermarks that were placed there secretively by the Trump administration that don't exist. These are amazing. You know, I think the potentials of comedy are high for many of us. But what do they tell us, right, about... Yeah. So I, you know, that once again, that story has not yet died, and it is immune to facts, apparently.
Yeah.
So there is a narrative irrationality as much as there's a narrative rationality.
Right. Well,
and
as long
that's,
as it's
that's,
got
that's
the
article that we didn't get written.
As long as it's got the invisible anchor points that give it rationality to the irrational, you know, the idea that there is a cabal behind this, that there's an invisible agreement between nefarious forces to try to take this away. So maybe that's what we should do next time. We should talk about the construction of the big lie and sort of take it apart. That would be
interesting. Well, I don't know that I don't know about you, but I have any new information to give it, but it is kind of the story. In fact, I think, and one has to organize certain experiences with that in mind. For instance, the Washington Post dropped a story about how there is one, political consulting outfit outside of Dallas that is responsible for perpetuating the big lie. I think, gee, to whom and for whom is that written as a kind of a piece of bolstering there, where it's not just a sort of amorphous,
right?
You know, a spirit of the masses that has risen up, conspiracy, that there's actually these active agents that made it happen is a different narration of how it got to be. And I'm not sure more true than the other, but.
Yeah, but those, you know, checking out all those story points and all the logic points and all that kind of stuff so that you can get a grip on maybe how to counter this story for people. I'm going to do the converting conservatives thing. I haven't run into, because I'm basically harvesting from people that I know that are nice people.
You don't have access to the inner.
Yeah, but sanctuary. I haven't dealt too much with the completely out there, you know, who've swallowed the hook, line, sinker, and the entire boat. But when you watch it in action, you're like, yeah, maybe we do need to throw some life buoys out there for people to hold on to so they don't sink all the way beneath the waters of this bullshit. So,
well, I'll send you this clip if I can find it that someone shared with me this week of of a guy, a sober reporter, I guess is what he is. But he's interviewing one of the Trump women, older woman, and she keeps going, what's wrong with that? And he says, you realize this is just conspiracy theory. She goes, well, can you tell me what's wrong with conspiracy theories? And then it moves to an older man who's at literally and I think genuinely in tears, going, they're killing babies and using them for spare parts. That fringe we don't really know how to deal with, but it's
right.
It's certainly there. And once again, just the reporter with his microphone sort of representing the weight of media and factuality. And in a way, these people are sort of saying, that just bounces off of me,
yeah.
Because there's some more compelling membership here in a truth that lives quite apart from that. And I think it is that apartness that needs to be investigated.
Yeah, it's interesting. Maybe we need, instead of trying to keep going into and disproving the big lie, we just need to build a better big truth. like use all the same.
Like in Poltergeist, where the woman goes down into the bowels of the creature just to rescue the child. So somehow we need the reportorial, unlike MSNBC, who just every day, and that's a lie, and that's a lie, and that's a lie.
Yeah. It's whack-a-mole.
Where's the journey into the heart of darkness? That's the new mission.
And that's kind of maybe what I'm thinking about. Like in Dante, when you read the whole series, like when he goes into hell, the Inferno is great, so much fun. And then he goes to purgatory, and that's kind of boring. And then he gets to heaven, and that's unreadable. It's like maybe
I want to be on the team when you decide this is going to be the documentary you make by going into the heart of darkness here.
Well, there's ways of going in there with armor. You watch the Daily Show do it all the time with sending guys in there that just, a little bit of humor, make these people look stupid and off you go.
Samantha Bee would be a warrior in this army. But.
So they've done that for a long time. And that's partly what I use. I use humor and I use techniques I'm not there to incite anybody or trigger them. That's not going to get me anywhere. But it is this sense, maybe we haven't told the big truth story strongly enough for people like that to attach to. Maybe the American story has lost its luster for a big portion of people. Now the conspiracy story and the dystopian has taken over. Maybe that's what we need to do, utopian.
I think maybe we have to sort of bracket for a moment and say, how is this their American story? Because really, it's a competition here. I'm hearing this a lot, echoed a lot on the media these days of, well, this group of people doesn't believe in democracy anymore. If you believe that you have really won the election and you're doing this on behalf of democracy, and once again, I wonder about those individuals if they lose the next election, do they still believe in democracy as much as they do at this moment? So I think there's a caution here about think of how many moments in history where either narrative could have won, right?
So. Well, when you look at the idea of the big truth, I mean, it is democracy is one of the planks, right? That's held up as, we could never lose democracy. That is the utopian. That's the sun in utopia world. And I've seen things recently talking about, all the different systems of democracies, all the different systems of governments, and Americans never really understand that these are all artificial constructions. They're just ways of doing things. And so maybe, I don't know, we'll talk about that next time. Just this idea of how do you give clarity and utopian hues to these things that people are saying, like, how could you let go of democracy? Well, make democracy look a lot better, because right now it looks like it's broken and confusing and not getting me what I want, especially to that, that side. So it's not just a narrative good for everybody.
Well, or their point of view is democracy already had been broken and they're trying to restore it somehow, which,
Well, and that fight between theocracy.
More emphasis on the demos than theocracy, I guess.
Anyway. Well, in that fight between theocracy and democracy, clearly they would choose a theocracy. I mean, there's no, sure. there's no doubt. And that's part of it too. Like you, these subdivisions that aren't really ever boiled up in the story, where they really talk about it in that way. Like, well, they're not really going anti-democracy. They're going pro theocracy or sure. pro-mythology.
And up until now, those two things have been, those two narratives have been playing with each other cooperatively. But I think what's significant is to note the rupture between the two. So where those things seem somehow to be at odds.
That's and the for same that group, thing they for, did in Iran, right? I mean, the theocracy came up and created ruptures because there was power to be had if you could rupture those connections. You know, it was moving towards democracy in the Middle East and Iran, especially in this sort of modern state. And theocracy's like, no, we're not going to win in there, you know?
Well, I suspect that they live in a kind of a dualism between their progressive and their conservative dimensions. I think we from our point of view sort of see them as all one or all the other, but that's probably not true where that there is genuine struggle and has been for any number of years. So I think maybe one of the questions that, have we arrived at that point?
Right.
Yeah, where this is going to always be present.
Yeah, these two huge juggernauts.
This is a new circumstance. You're never going to get that kind of agreement again. And so how does politics look different? And for the kind of talk that I do, it seems to me that the extreme liberals are the ones that need to hear that the most. You've got to get people to agree with you.
Well, it's Godzilla and King Kong.
Right, it's not enough.
Godzilla and King Kong have finally paired off, right? The fight is on, theocracy and democracy. And now, you know, you better learn how to fight if you're going to.
I think I'll watch it again with those two ideas in mind.
That's great. All right, man. Well, we're done. We're over. We're finished. Maybe next time. Yeah, let's, I don't know. It doesn't really matter.
We'll let it stew a few days.
Yeah, we'll come back to it.
All right, bud.
All right. I appreciate it. Once again, this has been Rhetoric Warriors Podcast, The Rhetoric Files, Dave Payne. We will see you again next time. Get out there and persuade people.